Thank you, Andrew, my inspiration and my true love, especially if you keep talking like that. Lovely. So, first of all, let me say this. I don't know how many of you were in the communion yesterday. Most of you, I'm guessing. Yeah. I like a lot of you, I look around and I see a lot of familiar faces. And so like a lot of you, probably, I started coming here when I was a kid. And in fact, I met my future wife here. But I can tell you this, I have never been more proud to be a Greenbelter than I was standing in that communion yesterday. I thought, this is who we are, and this is who we should be. We need to get better at it, sure, but we're starting. And maybe not many other places, not many other people are doing that. And that is relevant because the story I'm about to unfold for you is, on one level, a modern medical miracle. It's about the way that doctors and nurses, medical staff go the extra mile. It's about the way medical science has found astonishing ways to intervene in people's lives. But also, it's about the tenderness between families, between parents and children, and between strangers. That's an important part of the story. Can I just ask, I mean, this won't change anything, but I just wonder, did anybody here happen to hear the Radio 4 series of it when we did it? Okay, just a few. Right, if you like what you hear today, then go to iPlayer and listen to it. And right at the start of this, because the book was kind of parallel with the radio, but my understanding of the story deepened so much while I was doing the radio. I am going to ask you to applaud the man who produced it. Where is he? Jonathan, where are you? There he is, Jonathan Mayo. Who, in radio terms, has been teaching me how to tell stories, and I'm very glad to have him in my life. Right, enough of that. He's never heard me talk about him like that before, and I never will again. I want to take you to a situation. It's 2003. We have two boys for you to think about. The first one is called Mark. I wish I could show you a picture. He's blonde, he's sharp, he's got a kind of keen eye, he's a great footballer. He lives up in Johnston, just to the west of Glasgow, in a village called Lochwinnock, actually. He plays for the local football team. He's a terrific footballer. I mean, really, really good. He's possibly going to go all the way. His brother, Ryan, plays for St Mirren. They're a fierce Rangers family, this lot. And probably the highlight of the McKay, McKay is their name, the highlight of the McKay recent history is Ryan playing for St Mirren against Rangers at Ibrox. And if ever a family was conflicted, and luckily Ryan played very well, but Rangers won. So that's Mark. His dad's a little sort of, I don't know, a guy called Norrie, who's a roofer. He's small, he's determined. He's got a good line in wit. And his ex-wife, Linda, who's a nurse in the local hospital, and she is fiery and she's passionate and she is full of engagement with life. She once told me that she was a kid from a village in the countryside in Scotland, and she'd never even been to the dances. When she went to the big town of Johnston, which is, you know, you could walk through it by going just across there to Canopy. It's not a big place. But the first time she went to the big town to a big dance, to a disco, she was 17 years old, and this guy, Norrie, walked across the floor and said, "Do you want a dance?" And they got married about 6 months later. It wouldn't be a disservice to Linda to say that there was a reason for them getting married, and that's their eldest child. They're a lovely, lovely bunch of people. Linda had five children. She once said to me that the only thing that she did in the 80s was have children. And so you've got this family, Mark the footballer, Norrie the roofer, Linda the nurse, Mark's brothers and sisters, one sister, in the west of just west of Glasgow, in the summer of 2003. So that's one bunch of people. The other bunch of people, very quiet, very reserved, very English family called the Burtons, living in Grantham in Lincolnshire. Again, lovely people, very lovely people, but less demonstrative, much less demonstrative than the McKays. Really, in fact, Nigel, the father, is in the RAF, he's an RAF technician, and someone who keeps his emotions close to his chest. Sue, the mother, is a cost lawyer. She's very efficient, very much on top of things. And again, quiet, reserved, and cool. And their son is called Martin. And he loves his football. He's a bit of a wind-up merchant. He's a big, funny lad. He supports West Ham. And the only reason he supports West Ham is because his brother supports Nottingham Forest. And when he decided which team to support, West Ham had just beaten Nottingham Forest. That's the kind of lad he is. So we've got, remember these names. We've got Martin, the English kid in Grantham in Lincolnshire. And we've got Mark, the Scottish lad in Lochwinnock in Scotland. Mark, the footballer, and Martin, the fun-loving lad. They're both either side of their 16th birthday. And then, in the summer of 2003, in fact, it's the anniversary of what I'm about to describe. It was the anniversary yesterday, I think, of what I'm about to describe. In the summer of 2003, both of these boys, unexpectedly, without warning, fell seriously ill for different reasons. And let me take you through that. Mark, in the first place, the Scottish footballer, had been on holiday to Ibiza with his brother. He, you know, did what lads do when they go on holiday with their brothers to Ibiza. He lived a good life for a couple of weeks. So when he came home and he was complaining of stomach cramps and not feeling too good, went to the doctor. The doctor said, oh, you've overdone it. You just need to rest, take some paracetamol, you'll be okay. Mark actually said at that point, you know, I really didn't drink too much at all. And the doctor said, oh, come on, you're a teenager. We know the truth. Go home and have some rest. So Mark did, but as they were leaving the GP surgery, doubled up in the road, and he was going yellow, and he was doubling up in pain, and really, it was really hurting him. So his mum, in absolute frustration, having tried to get help from the doctor and kind of knowing in her bones as an assistant nurse that something was very wrong, thought, well, what can I do? I can't go back in the surgery. And he was, you know, he's collapsing on the pavement. What shall I do? If they she kind of knew that if they called an ambulance, it was in the mid-afternoon, if they called an ambulance, it would take a while to get there, but the hospital was just up the hill. So she put him in the back seat of the car, and she drove him to the hospital. And if it's okay with you, I'm just going to read a passage that opens the story. Mark was in agony, writhing around on the back seat of the car, calling for his mum. She was driving as fast as she could, up to the hospital and over the red warning lines, straight into the ambulance bay, blocking the way for everyone else. Linda didn't care. She thought her son was dying, and she was right. She leaned on the horn again and again, and the loud, flat sound echoed under the canopy, an alarm and a plea for help. Come out! Come on! Where are you? Mark couldn't walk, and there was no way she could carry a hefty, dazed teenager out of the car and all the way through the doors to accident and emergency. But surely someone in there would hear the noise and wonder what was going on. A hospital porter came over with an angry face. But Linda shouted at him, I'm not moving. Not until my son gets seen. The porter was confused because he knew her as a friend and a nurse who worked the night shift. Then he looked into the back of the car and saw Mark in a terrible state. Holy crap, Linda, is that your boy? Yanking open the car door, he swore loudly and waved at a colleague for a trolley. Mark didn't answer his questions, and Linda couldn't get the words out right. Just help him, please, she said. The porter took hold of Mark under both arms to lift him out and tried to be reassuring. We'll take him, Hen. You just get this thing moved, yeah? So Linda turned the key, put her foot down, and the car lurched forward out of the bay. She left it half up on a pavement and ran back through the double doors into the gloomy reception area where the faces of the sick and injured looked up at her. Where the hell was Mark? This way, shouted a voice she knew, and Linda saw the fuss around her son first. A couple of nurses in blue, busy with machines and a tangle of wires and tubing. More coming over. A young doctor in a white coat saying something about the lad being only 15. Mark was on the trolley in the middle of the growing crowd, already with a clear plastic breathing mask over his face. And then Linda knew, she just knew in her shock and horror, that this was as serious as it could be. My poor wee man is dying away. What was wrong with him? They didn't know at first. They could tell that organs were failing, but they weren't quite sure why. So they took him to the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, where it was established that what he had was the result of a virus. And here's what the book says about that. A virus had probably attacked Mark while he was on holiday in Ibiza. Maybe a snotty kid had wiped his runny nose with the back of a hand before leaving an invisible smear on a tabletop or a drinking glass. He would never have known he was a carrier. Fever was easy to miss in a hot place if you were in and out of the pool all day. Anyone could have come along and picked up the virus. But it was Mark who did so. Maybe as he took a drink or laid down a poker card. Maybe he put his fingers to his mouth just then, absentmindedly. Maybe he stopped to sneeze. Maybe his eye was irritated by a trace of sun cream, so he rubbed it. Either way, the bug entered his body. That was when his luck turned really bad. Most people catch a cold or a sore throat from the same virus, but after a few days, the body fights it off and the bad feeling passes. This time, the cells of the virus traveled through the bloodstream, all the way up to the meaty muscle of Mark's heart. This is the myocardium, and a bad attack by a virus leaves it thin and inflamed, a rare condition known as acute viral myocarditis. We don't pay that meaty muscle much attention, but it is the practical reason we go on living, the engine room of our ship, the physical source of the power that keeps the lights on. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. That's the rhythm of life, the sound of the engine working, pumping blood into the lungs to pick up the oxygen we need to survive, then pumping it on again to feed the rest of the body. When the engine fails, we know it. The lights start going out. So that was what was wrong with Mark. Up there in the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, his mum, Linda, was beside herself with worry. And in Edinburgh, they said, look, there's not really anything that we can do for him. We know that his heart is really in trouble, and we think that, to be honest with you, Linda, this is the end. Then Linda made an incredible offer, really. Linda was terrified. She was panicking and pleading in her head, praying, God, can I make a deal? Can I make a pact? Then she got an idea so crazy she thought it might just work. She grabbed the doctor's arm tight and yanked him, demanding his full attention. Listen, I'm 40. I've had my life. Can you not give Mark my heart here and now? She meant it too. They could have put Linda under with anesthetic right then and taken a knife to her chest and pulled out her heart to give to Mark and left her dead. And she would have let it happen without hesitation as his mum. I'm serious. I'm telling you. Why not? They couldn't, of course. No doctor would kill a healthy mother to save an ailing, almost adult son, no matter how much she pleaded, and the others all knew that. "Come on, Mum, come on," said Lisa, her daughter, pulling her close. So once again, Linda had to let her boy go, despite every instinct telling her that this journey would be his last. So they're in Edinburgh. They're told there's no hope. And then suddenly the doctor says, "Actually, do you know what? There is something we might be able to do. There's a machine down in Newcastle that could keep Mark alive while we can try and find him a heart transplant. There's a 1% chance that he'll make it. To be quite honest with you, he probably won't make it out of the hospital ward, down the corridor, and onto the plane that will take him to Newcastle." And of course, 1% is better than no percent, isn't it? So the family went, "Yeah, come on, we need to do this. Let's get on with it." So they were rushed from Edinburgh Royal Infirmary to Newcastle in a big specialist ambulance with three or four specialist attendants and all the equipment that he needed to keep him going at that time, including a pump that was working to support his heart. And they said, "Right, we're going to get you to the airport, and then we're going to get you all onto a plane, and then that's going to go down to Newcastle, and then we'll get you to the hospital." And the family said, "Can we come with him?" And the police said, "No, we can't really do that." Until it was agreed that Norrie, the father we talked about, would be able to go with the police in a police car to follow them down to the airport and then drive down as the plane flew. So Norrie's in the back of the car. In the police car, they're following the ambulance, they're blue lighting from Edinburgh down to the airport there. They pull up at the airport, they go round the back to the VIP strip and onto the tarmac where the plane is waiting. And then they realise, with a kind of sickening lurch, that somebody's booked the wrong plane. It should have been big enough to take all those people and all that equipment, but in fact, it was just a single engine Cessna that could only have taken a box for a transplant and nothing else. Now there's a problem, because the ambulance, as I understand it, and if there are medical people in the room and I get any of these details wrong, I'd love to hear from you, because this is what the doctors have told me, but I'm open to being corrected. As I understand it, the ambulance only had enough battery in the life support machines in the back of the ambulance to get it 2 hours down the road. But the road journey from Edinburgh to Newcastle at that time, as I understand it, was 2.5 hours in normal traffic. Geographically, if you're from that area, does that sound about right? Yeah? Someone's nodding. Thank you. It was by now the middle of the night, so it was probably faster than it would have been, but still there was normal traffic. Anyway, so they were really wondering, what do we do about this? And then the policeman said, "Look, don't worry about it. We're going to sort this out. We will get you there in 2 hours before the batteries die out." So having had a 1% chance of getting into the ambulance in the first place, Mark is now in the back of the ambulance, and you know, his chances of survival are infinitesimal at this point. And they're driving the ambulance as fast as they can down over the country park from Edinburgh to Newcastle. And in the back of the police car, following on, is Norrie. If I can find him, just bear with me. Okay, the police car rode the hills like a speedboat on the waves. Pushed back into his seat by the force of it all, Norrie felt sick to the stomach and gripped the handrest with fright. He didn't dare look at the speedo. They were plunging into deep space with the blackness wrapping back around them in the rearview mirror. The ambulance was just about in their slipstream, but suddenly they were slowing down. "What's up? What are we doing?" "This is England. We have to stop." The ambulance passed them by at speed as they pulled over, and Norrie was alarmed. "You're not going to let them leave me behind?" "No way, see?" Another police car sat in the lay-by ahead, this time with the markings of Northumberland Police. "Come on, Norrie, let's get you swapped," the officer said as he grabbed the spare oxygen bottles from the back seat, letting in a rush of cold air. Norrie tried to climb in the back of the ambulance, back of the police car. And the guy sitting in the front said, who was from Northumberland, said, "No, Jock, you sit in the front." Now, if you'd ever met Norrie McKay, you would know that you never call him Jock. But on this occasion, he was beside himself, so he did as he was told. And the ambulance disappeared over the hill. And Norrie must have looked really worried because the driver turned around to him and said, "Don't worry, Jock, we'll catch him." I'm reading again. "What happened next was a shock," says Norrie. "I swear it was like being in a plane. We nearly took off. I thought, my God, he's bombing it." They'd been going fast before north of the border, but this was something else, and it made Norrie laugh. He was getting hysterical with the grief, the stress, and the fear, but he was elated too. They were doing something for Mark at last. They were going somewhere. At least they were trying, all these people. The doctors, the nurses, the paramedics, the cops, all on his son's side. They were hurtling through the dark again. And then Norrie started to feel sick, because you would, wouldn't you? The thing is going very fast indeed. And so, being Norrie, he said, the driver said, "Are you all right?" And Norrie said, "Oh, not really. Can I have a cigarette?" "What?" said the police driver. "No way, pal, you're in a police car." The driver was concentrating on the road, but after a few moments, he must have thought about his passenger and how there would be nobody else to clear up the mess, because he changed his mind. "Special circumstances, all right." So you've got this situation where Norrie opened a window, just a crack, and the wind was raging in his ear, because they were going 100 miles an hour at least, I would think, at this point. And so he tried to light his fag out of the window, like, right? And tried to blow smoke out of the window, and it was in his face. And there was ash all over his face. It was Ash Wednesday in the car. And the driver said, "Nice one, Jock." Anyway, Norrie laughed because he was high on adrenaline, and within seconds, they were in, as it felt to him, they were in Newcastle. When they got to the Freeman Hospital, the distractions of the drive fell away, and he was hit again by the full force of what was happening to his son. Norrie expected to walk into the hospital and be told that Mark was dead, but there was nobody to meet them. The policeman led the way up the stairs. But as they were going up the stairs, they saw the doctors and the nurses who had been in the ambulance, and one particular medic that he recognized from before, who was looking absolutely exhausted. And the man had clearly been crying, his face was wet with tears, and Norrie felt a rush of despair as he realized what that must mean, that this senior medic who had been in the back of the ambulance with Mark was now in tears. And as they passed on the stairs, the man reached out and put his hand on his shoulder, and Norrie braced himself. And the medic said, "Your son is a hell of a fighter. He's still alive in there." So we leave Mark in Newcastle in the hospital, and we go to Grantham in Lincolnshire, where Martin, happy-go-lucky, big, bumptious 16-year-old, has come in from playing football with his mates in the park, and his mum's not there, she's at swimming. So, you know, he's had a big, big dinner, but he's a big, big lad, so he's had some Cocoa Pops as well. And why have one bowl when you can have two? So he's sitting there watching TV. His favourite programme was Celebrity Big Brother, actually, but it had just finished, so he was watching something else. And then when Sue came in, the two of them sat together on the sofa and had a bit of a coddle, and he put his feet over her. His dad, Nigel, was in America at the time with the RAF, and he was on maneuvers there. So they'd had a phone call earlier in the evening, and they just sort of chatted away. And Martin was a big old softie, and he liked cuddly toys. So he'd said to his dad, "Are you going to bring me home a cuddly?" And his dad, in immortal words, said, "No, son, I'm not going to bring you home a cuddly. Las Vegas is not really the place for cuddlies." They were on maneuvers in the desert and staying in Las Vegas. And then, about 2 o'clock in the morning, Sue was asleep. She'd left Martin by the telly. And he'd gone up to bed. And then this happened. Sue woke at 2 in the morning because of the noise. There was a lot of banging and bumping coming from Martin's room across the landing. I'm just thinking, if I'm going too fast, let me know. Okay. This wasn't fair. She had to get up early for work. Martin, what on earth are you doing? She sat up in bed just as her son appeared in the doorway, a silhouette in the dark. He looked strange in the half light, but she couldn't say why. Martin looked into the room at his mum, but somehow looked right through her, as if he couldn't see or recognize her face. Martin! His answer was just a mumble. Was this one of his jokes? Had he fallen out of bed and banged his head? What's the matter, love? Stop prattling about! He mumbled again and took a couple of steps forward, but his knees buckled and he collapsed face down on her bed. Frightened now, she shook him out, but he slid off and rolled onto the floor. Get up! Come on! But Martin was slumped against the side of the bed in his pajamas, the shirt riding up. His mother touched his face and it was warm but not fevered. She stroked his hair once, maybe twice, trying to be calm, but feeling the fear rising as she wondered what on earth to do. The only phone was across the landing in the spare room, so she ran in there to phone for an ambulance, calling back, "Hang on, love, hang on. Is he breathing?" The emergency operator wanted to know, so Sue rushed back to check, rolling Martin into the recovery position as best she could. He was a big lad. Breathing, yes, with a guttural noise like a deep snore that scared her. "That's when I realized it was really serious," she said. "He wasn't getting up, but it still never entered my mind that this could be life-threatening." The operator got her to put him into position and to get her keys and her phone and to wait for the ambulance. And the ambulance came and they shone a light in his face and they put him into the ambulance and they drove just around the corner to Grantham Hospital, only 2 minutes away really. And Grantham's a hospital, very small hospital. There was nobody there on reception or anything else, so they had to go through these darkened corridors, the lights coming on as they went in. And there were no other patients waiting to be seen. The little hospital was empty. So Sue sat there in the early hours, wondering what was going on. Now, I should point out at this point that Sue was an RAF wife. She was very much in charge of herself. And she was thinking, I'm not going to panic. I'm not going to contact anybody. He's just had a bump on the head. It's all going to be okay. And the nurse kept coming in to say, "Do you want to call somebody?" And she kept saying, "No, no, no." And then as the hours went by, the nurse became more and more insistent. And then the nurse returned at 4 a.m. and said, "It really would be best if you would call someone to offer you support." And Sue says, "That's when the penny dropped. She was drip feeding me. This was the first time anyone had said it was really serious." But they weren't going to tell her how serious it was until there was someone there to hold her hand or to catch her fall. So Martin Burton, the happy-go-lucky 16-year-old from Grantham, on the night that Mark was up in Newcastle fighting for his life, Martin was being transferred in a high-speed ambulance from Grantham to Nottingham, where there were specialists. And there, the children's intensive care unit was led by one of the most wonderful, caring, giving men I think I've ever met in my professional life, a fantastic doctor called Harish Vyas. And it was 5:30 in the morning when the phone rang in Harish Vyas's house. And he was already up and he was already dressed because he's an early riser. And so he was told there was a lad on his way into the hospital and that he should get ready to come in and see what was going on. Now, what you have to understand about Harish is that he had single-handedly built up the children's unit at Nottingham. And he had a deep, deep commitment to his patients that really, you know, if you didn't match that with his staff, you were going to get left behind. So the people who worked with him in that unit were used to going the extra mile. And when I asked Harish why he did that, He told me a story that will resonate when we finish in a few minutes' time. He said that when he was a young student, he was brought up in Kenya of Indian descent, and he was in London studying medicine, and his grandfather came to visit him. His grandfather was called Shambu, and he was a campaigner, really, for justice in his community. And he had seen in his time many people go into the medical profession in his community and become corrupt and only serve the rich. And so he traveled to London to see his grandson, knowing actually that he was terminally ill. And he went to see Harish and he said, "Do you promise to put your patients first and to always practice medicine in that way?" And Harish, being a young student, went, yeah, granddad, yeah, sure, yeah. And Shambu said, it's almost biblical, this, in the way it was repeated. So no, do you promise to put your patients first? And Harish, clocking that he was being a bit more serious than he thought, said, I do, I really do, actually. And the grandfather said, okay, well, if you promise, I want you to promise by doing this. And he took Harish's hand, and he placed it on his chest, where his heart would be. And he said, promise on the heart of your grandfather. And Harish did. That will come back to have a mighty resonance in a few minutes' time. I'm not going to go through the whole story because we haven't got time, and I want you to buy the book, let's be honest. What are we doing for time? What time is it? Half an hour. Okay, so what I'd like to do is to say a bit more and then open it up for questions, if that's all right. So what I will tell you is that Martin's dad was in Las Vegas, and so he was then told, you need to get back to London as quickly as possible. So in the book, there's this race against time for the father to be back from America. It's a 19-hour journey, during which it occurs to Nigel, while he's waiting at Pittsburgh Airport, that he's actually being brought back. He's not being told anything because they don't want to disturb him too much. They want to get him back before they tell him the full strength of what's happened. But it occurs to him that he's being brought home in order to give permission to turn off the life support machine. So in Pittsburgh Airport, he puts his coat over his head and cries his eyes out for 2 hours. When he eventually got to Nottingham, to the hospital, 9:30 on the Thursday morning, it was quickly obvious that the situation was as serious as it could be, and Harish came in to talk to the families and said, look, actually what has happened here is that Martin is brain dead. He had suffered a burst vessel in the side of his brain and had had a flood of blood that is described in medical terms as catastrophic. And the guttural snoring noise that she had heard while he was laying on the floor was the sound that his breathing was making because that part of his brain had fallen back into his air passage. So at the point that he fell on the floor, he was almost certainly, in medical terms, brain dead. Harish, in that moment, said, I'm really sorry what has happened, but have you considered organ donation? Now, when I first heard that, I said to him, you know what, Harish, that's brutal, isn't it? And he said, yeah, it is. It is brutal. But it's necessary. Because if you leave it any longer than that, quite often the families have descended into grief and can't think straight anyway. And when I spoke to Sue and said, what do you think about that? She said, no, to be honest, in an hour's time after that or 2 hours' time, I wouldn't have known my own name, let alone how to answer the question. Now, in her case, Nigel and her, because he was an RAF personnel, I think, had spoken about donation and they knew what they wanted to do. They anticipated it would be one of them, but since it was Martin, they were able to apply the same principles, and they just said straight away to the doctor, yes, we would like that to happen. And even in the moment, they were able to articulate later as saying, we would like some good to come out of the tragedy that's happening to them. And when I asked them about that, because it seems a little sort of, I don't know, detached, they said, well, it's not detached at all, because there is no way to stop what is happening in front of you. They had, of course, suspected what he was going to say. And there's no way to argue against it and say, surely you're wrong. Brain dead is brain dead. And in their understanding, you know, medical people might argue about it, but in their understanding, that was that. So the next instinct was to say, well, if you're saying that good can come from this, then we should do it. Now, the fact of the matter is, when it comes to organ donation, almost everybody agrees that it's a good idea and that organs should be available, and we'd quite like one if we needed one, right? I think we all probably agree with that, right? But when it comes to actually signing up on the organ register, less than 30% of us actually do that. So there's this gulf, and I've got to be completely honest with you. When I started to write this story and find out about the Burtons and the McKays, I was squeamish about transplants, and I was squeamish about anything to do with it. I didn't want to think about death, and I didn't want to think about what happens to my body or the body of my loved one afterwards. And my head was full of having written stories about Alder Hey and organ scandals and lots of other stories where perhaps doctors may have been perceived to have overstepped the mark. But while I was writing this story, both Nigel and Sue, the parents of Martin, at different points said to me, if one of your children, I've got two boys and two girls, if one of your children needed a heart, would you want it? And I said, of course. To be honest, I'd offer my own as Linda did. At least I hope I would. And they said, well, if that's the case, if your child is going to die anyway, why would you deny that to some other parent? I found that very difficult to answer, and I still do. And I'm proud to say that partly as a result of this story and partly as a result of the publicity this has got, that the debate has changed in Scotland to such an extent that they're now moving towards the opt-out system, whereby you will have to opt out if you don't want to give your organs away. And for us, as people who understand life with a spiritual dimension, this is a really fascinating moment for all sorts of reasons. And one of those reasons is that it took 8,000 years of human surgery before anybody is known officially to have interfered with the heart. 8,000 years. One of those reasons is because, of course, it's very difficult to get to. But another is that the heart's has been considered taboo. It's been, of course, considered the seat of the soul. We talk, don't we, about God being in our hearts. It's seen by many Muslims as the way by which you discern the presence of Allah. Going all the way back to the ancient Egyptians, it was believed that the heart was measured, weighed in the afterlife to decide whether you'd had a good life or not. And the lighter your heart, the better time you had. Until in 1893, a heroic guy called Daniel Hale Williams broke the taboo. In his hospital in America, somebody was brought into the hospital with a stab wound to the heart, and Daniel Hale Williams, knowing full well that most doctors would get struck off or shunned if they operated on the heart, said, no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stitch up the pericardium, the sac around the heart, and I'm going to repair this man, I'm going to save his life. And the guy did live for another 38 years. And that was the first known heart operation. And what is astonishing, and at the same time, what made that possible is that Daniel Hale Williams was an African-American doctor working in a hospital for the poor that he had started that was entirely staffed by African-American nurses only a few decades after the Declaration of the Freedom of Slaves. So being struck off or being ostracized didn't really apply in that culture at that time. Anyway, bringing this bit to a close, we have now got Martin in Nottingham, brain dead, and the parents have said yes to organs being donated. And we've got Mark up in Newcastle, who is desperate for a heart. If he doesn't get a heart, then he's not going to live. And what happened then is they took the heart of Martin Burton and they lifted it out of his body and they put it into an ice box, like a picnic box we've been using all weekend, although with more ice in it, I suspect. And they took it as fast as they could. There's a race against time. You've got 4 hours before the heart begins to deteriorate. Again, a race against time across country by air and by road to Newcastle, where this heart is rushed into the theatre. And the existing heart of Mark McKay is, the taps are turned off, as the surgeon put it. The heart surgeon, who's a wonderful man, who learnt his trade in a hospital in Belfast during the Troubles, is completely unflappable, describes himself as a plumber. He says, we turn the taps off, we take the heart out, and we put the other heart in. Simple. Not so, sir. And I describe in the book why it's not so. And then this astonishing thing happens. You get this lifeless, flabby, white heart, which has pretty much given up the ghost, and it's put over there. And you get this compact, bluish, whitish heart that's been travelled in the ice, and it goes into the body, into the chest cavity. And then they do connect up the pipes. And they do have plugs on the supply, and they do open up the supply from one end. And then the blood does come into the heart, and then you see the heart colour begin to change from white and blue and lifeless to a little bit pink and then a nice rosy pink. And then this amazing thing happens, miraculous thing happens, that the chemicals in the blood cause a reaction, and from nowhere the spark of life comes. And electricity causes the heart to pulse, so that all on its own, without anybody doing anything, this still heart that's been in the air 2 hours ago, been packed in ice, now warm and beginning to have that lifeblood in it, just goes boom, 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 boom. Erratically at first, and then it finds its own rhythm. And that heartbeat begins again, the miracle of life. The surgeon, Leslie Hamilton, said that for him, he'd seen it many times, but it was still, every time he saw it, a jaw-dropping miracle. I asked him, as a believer, actually he's a believer, he's a Catholic, we used to believe for most of human history that the soul left the body at the point at which somebody died, and we used to believe that that was the point at which the heart stopped beating. So therefore, if you take the heart out of one person and put another one in, where does the soul go? He said, that's above my pay grade. Mark recovered, had many, many more years of life. And then we had the privilege, Jonathan and I had the privilege of going to Scotland and being in a room with Mark McKay, who was now 28 years old or 29, and Sue Burton, the mother of Martin, who had died and whose heart had been given away. And they got to meet. And I'll finally close this bit of the thing before I open up for questions, if I may, by just reading to you what happened when they met. Now, here it is, the moment. A happy ending of sorts in this story of horrors, trials, and wonders. They've not seen each other for a while, but Mark and Sue are together at last on a sofa in the lodge, in the hotel in the Scottish countryside, where his mum works as a housekeeper. The night's come, but the lamp in here casts a golden glow. This is the first time they've sat down to properly talk about everything that happened, and Sue knows what she wants to say. It sounds like a rehearsed speech because she has rehearsed this in her mind many times. I should break in and explain to you that it's almost unheard of for the people who give, who receive organs and the families of those who give them to meet up. But this happened by a series of extraordinary coincidences that are explored in the book, which meant that first of all, the two mothers were able to meet up and become friends. And then there were these series of meetings between the mother and the boy who was saved. And that's where we join.
And Sue said to Mark, I don't want you to feel guilty because Martin died and you lived. Martin was going to die. We agreed to donate his organs when he died, and we are thrilled to know that lives have been saved. Mark looks uneasy, unsure how to respond. He's grateful, of course, for everything that's happened, but struggles for a way to express that. He's still got health problems. A transplant can't solve them. But he feels fitter than he has for years. All this would have been too much to hope for or pray for a dozen years ago when his mum was pacing the hospital corridors, pleading with God to take her life in return for his, as she often reminds him. Mark's a bit overwhelmed by Sue's presence when he sees her again, as he said he would be. How are you supposed to thank somebody for giving you a heart? He says. It's the biggest gift anyone could give, and there's no way to say thanks. Perhaps there is a way, though. Actions might speak louder than words. Would he allow her to place her hand on his chest? You're getting me embarrassed now, he says, as if he wants to refuse. But he can see that Sue wants to do it. So the answer has to be yes. I'm getting upset now myself, she says with a sniff. But she still shuffles up closer to him. Slowly, awkwardly, assuming that it's all right, she reaches across him as if to lay hands in prayer. Mark lets her put her palm against his chest, just left of center where the heart is. Then he covers her hand with his own and presses it gently against him. Yeah, he's saying, you can. Feel the heart. Sue closes her eyes and breathes deeply. It's a very special thing for Mark to feel it's okay for me to do this, she says. They're both still for a moment as she keeps her eyes closed and concentrates, and then this smile spreads across Sue's face. She's beaming. Under her flat palm, she can feel the warmth of his body, and under that, the heart of her lost boy, the rhythm of life, the double thump, as if it is repeating the name of her son over and over again. Martin. 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 The heart that grew in her womb, the heart Martin was born with and kept him alive for 16 years, always beating, unseen, on all the days she could remember. The day he took his first steps, the day he wouldn't let go of her hand at the school gate, the day he fell down in the park and she picked him up and hugged the hurt away. The heart was always there, always constant, always beating. At home, on the sofa, on that last night together, as they chatted and laughed, the heart was in him and he was alive. Then he was gone. The ache is still so hard to bear, it catches her breath after all this time. But now, here, under her fingertips, she can feel the rhythm that was his. A beat that began within her and grew louder in him and is now somehow still carrying on, impossibly, under the thin, scarred skin of this other boy, this man. That is really special to me, says Sue slowly, her head, her hand still in place like a blessing. To be able to feel the heart that Martin was born with still beating, it's just incredible to me. And this is not a quick grab of the hand. This is a moment that lingers with a silence that grows. They are hip to hip on the sofa, the Scottish lad startled by the emotion of it all, and the English woman leaning across him almost in an embrace, almost like mother and son. Almost, but not quite. This is a rare kind of closeness that so few people can ever know because the circumstances are so extraordinary. She lost her son and then his body was divided up. She survived a powerful grief and learned at last to let him go. But now, incredibly, all these years later, she can feel for herself that a part of him is so very much alive. And Mark, can feel this stranger close. He can feel her hand on him and his heart beating under it, and yet he knows that the heart was not always his. It belonged to a boy who was and is so deeply loved by his mum, this woman whose hair is in Mark's face, whose scent is in his nostrils. No wonder they're both quiet. What can anyone say to any of that? A nervous little chuckle comes out of nowhere, surprising Mark. Sue echoes him and they shuffle apart, each looking happy but far away, shocked by what's just happened. I don't think that you're aware of your own heart, says Sue for something to say, nerves quickening her speech. You might hear it sometimes, but not often, and we rarely touch other people like this. I could feel Mark's heart beating strongly. For that, I'm really grateful. It's only when she gets up to make another mug of tea for us all that I realize I've just heard Sue call it Mark's heart. The heart that used to belong to the boy she misses every day. The loud, cheeky, lovely boy she lost far too soon, but whose death brought life. Martin, the boy who gave his heart away.
Cole, thank you so much. We have about 10 minutes for questions. And as this talk is being recorded, we really need to hear them via the microphone. So if you are able, please come and maybe queue up by the microphone. We can clear a little space around it and ask your questions. I know that Cole will be very ready to answer them.
And while we're waiting for that, if you would like to buy the book, it will be next door and I'll be going and signing some copies afterwards.
But we need some questions.
Not a question, but just a comment. In Wales, the opt-out system has been in place now for some time. And interestingly, it was opposed by the Archbishop of Wales, Barry Morgan. I'm not quite sure on what grounds, but I think he was arguing that the willingness to give, to donate organs should be a positive decision rather than, as he felt, a negative thing. But it's been in operation now, I think, for nearly a year.
I didn't know that. Thank you for letting me know.
I've got a quick question, Colin. It's probably too big a one in some ways, but you'll wrestle as a journalist with ethical questions every day. This strikes me as the kind of story that is, you know, there are lots and lots of challenges that you must have faced. Even just speaking to the families who may have even been eager to tell you their story, but at the same time you're interested in their welfare, their well-being, in revisiting a very traumatic incident. Were there particular kind of concerns you had in telling the story, partly of somebody, you know, who died and isn't there to kind of object in that sense? Was it a more or less kind of tricky story to tell than those that you've told in the past?
Thank you. I think one very important aspect of it is that it's not my story, in the sense that it's not about my impressions of Britishness or the Irish situation or my dad, which is what I'd written about in books before. And so the project was very much to serve somebody else's story and to try and tell it in a way that would get a lot of information and drama across, but also that would take you into the emotional truth of the situation for the families. And one of the kindest, loveliest things I've heard, really, the families say, they've said many lovely things, is that I think it was Linda, the mother, who, you know, truth is she was not looking forward to reading this book, as you can well imagine. She said that she sat down at 10 o'clock in the morning to read it, and when she looked up from the book, it was 5 o'clock and it had gone dark and everybody needed feeding. And I thought, well, yeah, okay. We've done all right then. So there was an obligation in the writing of the manuscript itself to do the right thing by the families and also by the medics, because this is also the story of the medics involved. And so they all had manuscripts and they all came back with changes. And really, by that time, it was a question of the trust that had been built up between us. And at this point, you know, not wishing to spare his blushes, I want to mention Jonathan again, because I had begun to explore this story and think about whether it was tellable in a book, and then the opportunity came up to make the radio series. And the radio series was the first one I'd ever done, and so I was in John's hands,
And when we went to Scotland, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that we didn't really, we weren't quite sure what we were going to get, wasn't it? And we weren't quite sure how far we could go in asking the families to tell their story. And then what unfolded in front of us in these rooms in Scotland was this wonderful, fiery Scottish family and this wonderful, cool, reserved English family and the voices of those two people intertwining, the two mothers. And then there was this moment when Mark and Sue were together. And I knew that they'd had a fleeting hand-on-heart moment in Canada before. And so both of us were sort of thinking, well, you know, we've got to get them to, for the radio, we've got to get them to see if we can do that. And I was thinking, well, ethically, how do I ask them to do that? But actually, it then emerged that Sue, something she said just gave a clue that she had felt ambivalent about the Canadian experience. She wasn't quite sure what it meant. And so the opportunity to do it again was not something she would ever ask for, and yet it was something that she really desperately wanted. So therefore, it gave us permission to do that. And the reason I'm leading up to that is because you then get this journalistic truth. And I'm, you know, doesn't, well, you'll have your own view on whether it reflects well on us or not. But there's a journalistic truth that you're seeing that unfold in front of you. Me trying to encourage them to talk. Jonathan's sitting there on the microphone, getting the levels right and making sure we're covering the right ground. And then this extraordinary hand-on-heart moment happens. And we sort of respectfully say, oh, right, okay, fine, finish the thing. And then, well, I don't remember whether we did or not, but certainly in our own heads, we both went outside and punched the air. Right? Because journalistically, in that moment, we'd got to the point where there was something that really revealed the truth of what was happening. And so you have to, ethically, you have to hold both those things in tandem all the time. And the only way it's possible to do that in a story like this is if you've got the absolute trust of both the families involved, which the glory in this goes to them for having had the courage to do that.
Hi. First of all, just thank you for the story. I'm a very junior doctor, brand new, and we don't get told stories very much in medical school, and I think that stories contribute more than the textbooks do in how I approach things. I have a question about the anonymity that happens between donors and recipients. I think there are some obvious problems that could arise if it's automatic that people know each other, but this story is really beautiful, and this story has encouraged so you to think about organ donation, us to think about organ donation. And I wonder if you think that there could be room, more room for people meeting each other in a structured way to encourage others.
Well, first of all, thank you for being a doctor. In this particular case, it sort of all ran away from them a bit. When you get contact from, you're quite often encouraged as a recipient to perhaps write a note to the person who gave, the family of the person who gave up the organ, and you'll probably do it anonymously. It'll say, Cole, 50, Sussex, thank you very much for the liver that allowed me to live, or whatever, on a little note. In this case, Linda McKay, being who she is, was a little bit more effusive and sent a photograph, and Sue sort of responded to that, but it was still anonymous. There were still just images, really, without proper names or places. And then the beginning of all this story for me is that I was on The Big Questions with Nikki Campbell talking about some other issue as a kind of talking head, which I do occasionally, and Sue was on there telling her story and talking about donation. And then while she was on the TV, they flashed up a picture of Martin, her son. And this was the same picture that she'd sent to Linda. And so Linda's granny, Mark's granny, Linda's mum, so the Scottish family, the grandmother of Mark, the footballer who died, Linda, the mother, the granny was watching it. Everybody else in the McKay family was in bed. It was Sunday morning, after all. And the granny, Linda says she woke up to 12 missed calls. From the granny saying, I think that's the donor. I think that's where Mark's heart comes from. And so, by the wonders of Facebook, she found Sue Burton in Lincolnshire, and she contacted her.
So it ran away from the medical professionals in that sense. And that's part of what made it a rarity. There was more than that in the sense that the mothers then became close. I think if you're asking me, do I think that more donors and recipients should meet, I think that they probably should. And the Burtons are really big players in the donor family network, which supports the families of people who've given up organs. And I'd encourage you to look at the Donor Family Network as a charity to support. But they would also say that it has to be really carefully managed because it can be very, very difficult. It brings up all sorts of emotional issues. I haven't got time to go into them here, but there are cases, particularly in research that's been done in America, or where people who have received organs have become a little bit too attached to the families of the people who gave them up. Yeah. So it's a complicated issue. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we might have time for one more question. So you're happy not... Do you feel your answer's already taking place? Thank you. This last question.
I'm very quick. Cole, I know that you're a commentator on medical ethics issues. Do you think the emphasis placed upon saving human life, preserving human life, should always be the overwhelming value across all the issues like euthanasia and assisted suicide, or are there exceptions?
How long have we got, John? Yes. John's been trying to ask me that question all weekend. No, is the answer to your question. I think our friend the doctor would probably agree that as people of faith, people who believe there's a spiritual dimension, we are now in the borderlands where we don't really know what the rules are or what the territory is, where people are staying alive for much longer than they might have done. They're being saved much younger than they might have been in the womb. And also, they are perhaps, as a result of our ability to keep them, their body ticking over, they're also potentially suffering much more than they were in the past. And another person that I've written about, who I was proud to call a friend, was somebody from Bradford called Debbie, who for my shame, I can't remember her surname. It'll come back to me as soon as I finish saying this. Who wrote a book about the fact that she had a disease that was slowly taking over her body, and she said she wrote a book about the fact that she wanted to be able to go to Dignitas and take her life because that would allow her to live as full a life as she possibly could until the moment when it was too late. So I think it's really, really complicated. I don't think that you can stick your finger on a Bible page and find the answer. I think we are having to do some thinking and feeling and imagining for ourselves, and I think we need all the help we can get.